Thank you. Thank you very much. So in this talk, I would like to tell you about some recent work in collaboration with mainly with Daniel Sudarsky and also with Edward Wilson. And there are some things that we discussed and done with James Bjorken. Some people know about this, some of these things, because I talked about it recently in Loops. So the first part of the talk is going to be a bit maybe boring for those that have seen this, but there are new. There is a second part of the talk that is completely new. Okay, so the idea is, so if nature is fundamentally discrete, it is very good to use mathematical. We used to use mathematical models that describe physics in terms of continuous variables. But we know that such models are bound to fail at some regime if the fundamental degrees of freedom are discrete. An example of that is the Navier-Stokes description of fluids, for instance, that certainly breaks down when we get to scales comparable with molecular scales. And another example we could argue is general relativity. If we, from the point of view of quantum gravity, we expect physics to be described at the Planck scale by fundamentally discrete objects. In both cases, or in cases where one does this, then the most generic effect that we can expect is the effective violation of energy conservation, in the sense that there can be flow of energy into these degrees of freedom that we are not describing in our equations, and therefore this will be seen as energy being lost. So what I want to... that means friction, right? I mean, this is how we... I mean, a bicycle is a macroscopic object, and we can stop a bicycle thanks to the molecules. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to. And that's an effective violation of energy conservation if I think of the kinetic energy of the bicycle and I forget about the molecules. So similarly, I want to argue that like the bicycle in the cosmological setup, this could be a way of understanding the present accelerated expansion of the universe. So we're going to talk about the cosmological constant or dark energy. And so it's nice to mention the cosmological constant problem.
Somebody.
Okay.
I was trying to find a way.
And so, just quickly, the cosmological constant problem. I mean, if you naively think that the dark energy or that the cosmological constant is vacuum energy in quantum field theory, so in the context of quantum field theory on flat space-time, then you see that contributions to the vacuum energy diverge, but you might think of some cutoff and that regularizes these divergences. But the problem is that this naive view leads to huge contributions to the cosmological constant. If you put the cutoff at the Planck scale, you get a result that is 120 orders of magnitude, way too big. But of course, the true question is, how is it that vacuum energy gravitates? So it's a question not about quantum field theory alone, it's a question for quantum gravity. So we can just, from the point of view of the classical theories of gravity, then unimolar gravity comes out as a very nice example that completely resolves the problem of the cosmological constant. So unimolar gravity is just a trace-free Einstein's equations. It was introduced by Einstein in 1919, thinking about some model of nuclear structure. But in the paper, he's happy with this theory, in particular for one reason, that the cosmological constant in this theory appears as a constant of integration, as we will see later. And at the time, he was still thinking that the cosmological constant was necessary to make the universe static. And so he liked this better than his cosmological constant proposal, because the cosmological constant in this theory would not be a fundamental constant, but it would be one of the initial data that you have to give in the theory. And more recently, this theory also became relevant from the point of view of the cosmological constant problem now, when Weinberg pointed out that this theory is nice with respect to the vacuum energy problem, because vacuum energy does not gravitate in unimolar gravity, for the simple reason that the vacuum expectation value of the energy momentum tensor contributes only to the trace, and the trace of the energy momentum tensor doesn't appear in this equation, in the field equations. So this is an example of a theory where the problem is completely trivialized. There is no gravitational effect of vacuum energy in unimolar gravity. Unimolar gravity is completely equivalent to general relativity if energy momentum is conserved. So if these two ingredients are given, the trace-free Einstein's equations plus the assumption that energy momentum divergence of T mu nu is equal to zero, so that the local energy conservation is conserved, then you just get general relativity with a constant, which is of integration that is has the effect of a cosmological constant. So this is not a strong assumption because, you know, it's just tied to the assumption of smoothness all the way down to all scales. Because if you have some matter coupling that is generally covariant, then divergence of T mu nu equal to zero follows directly from diffeomorphism invariant. And in physical terms, this is something that we can tie to the fact that at a point, the space-time geometry can always be well approximated by flat space-time with all the symmetries, the Poincaré symmetries of flat space-time, and all the conserved quantities associated to these Poincaré symmetries are organized in this local conservation of energy momentum. But if space-time, smooth space-time, is only an approximation of this more fundamental reality, then we have no reason to keep this second ingredient. And then unimolar gravity gives us a very natural generalization of GR as an open system in which we can have diffusion, namely a failure of ingredient number two. The standard gravity cannot do that because divergence of T mu nu is a consequence of the Bianchi identities or a consequence of the field equations. So, and this is independent of your view about quantum gravity. If the fundamental degrees of freedoms are discrete, then we could imagine a situation where this equation, in an effective sense, doesn't make sense anymore. So what we mean, I mean, this is another cartoon. So if at the fundamental level there is no notion of tangent space, then we should expect this equation to fail. Or the possibility that this happens. So let's come back to the trace-free Einstein's equation, so unimolar gravity, and let me show you what happens if the energy momentum tensor is not conserved. So here you see the trace-free Einstein's equations that I have just reorganized in a way to get the Einstein tensor here. So now you take the divergence of this equation and use the Bianchi identities, and so you get an equation for the gradient of this combination of the Ricci scalar and the trace of the energy momentum tensor equal to the divergence of T mu nu, that from now on I'm going to call J. So this is the current of energy momentum violation, we could say. If this current is close, so if the integrability conditions of these equations hold, I can integrate this equation and plug the result back into the previous equation. What we get is an effective Einstein's equation with a dark energy term that is fed. For first, there is a constant of integration lambda zero. This is what you would have if you had energy momentum conservation, and that would be the cosmological constant as a constant of integration. But in addition to that, you have the integral of this one form along a line that connects some reference point to the point where you're at. And because the integrability conditions hold, the path you choose is independent of the path you choose. So this is well defined. So what we see is that if energy momentum conservation fails, if you have diffusion into this underlying discreteness degrees of freedom, then the energy loss would feed a term in the effective Einstein's equations that behave like dark energy. So the question we asked was, is it possible to construct a model that predicts a model for this J from quantum gravity considerations, from what we know about quantum gravity, or what we think we know about quantum gravity? And so what we would like to have is a model that depends only on fundamental constants and does not require one to arbitrarily set the initial time Now, we're going to apply this to cosmology, of course, at which this diffusion starts happening. We would like the model to tell us ourselves, to tell us when is it that this diffusion, when is it that this J is different from zero. And so, and I want to tell you how we found this model. So, but the first guiding principle for us was the fact that one cannot think of this discreteness in quantum gravity, like the one predicted by loop quantum gravity, as something selecting a global rest frame. It's not the discreteness like molecules. I mean, that you should not think of this discreteness as selecting a particular rest frame, because if you do, then and if you think about effective field theories living on that with interactions, with non-trivial interactions, you can see that relative corrections would have the effect of producing all sorts of operators in your effective Lagrangian. And because there is because you're violating Lorentz invariance, then you would produce operators that violate Lorentz invariance. And anything is possible, and you would produce those operators that are very dangerous, which are those that have dimension 4 and less, which are not suppressed by the Planck scale. And indeed, you can show that the... So you're going to get operators in your Lagrangian which violate Lorentz invariance, which are suppressed only by the coupling constants of your model, say the standard model, which is way too big. So if you, so that's why this type of Lorentz violation cannot be allowed. But there is a loophole to this argument, which is it could happen that these violations are only manifest when you have curvature. And this is what I want to represent with this cartoon. So if I have a two-dimensional surface made of tiles where the surface is flat, then I don't see the discreteness. But when I try to have curvature, then the corners of the tiles become apparent. And that would be allowed because it would still be true that you can generate anything, but the things you generate will have to be suppressed by curvature. And then we wouldn't have seen this because we basically have tested our interacting field theories in a situation where space-time is close to flat.
So are you thinking about the tiles of a space or a space-time?
I don't want to be anything. I mean, I don't want to be specific about it. I don't need to. So how do we define? What do we mean by this discreteness? What is it? And how can it be compatible with the low energy Lorentz invariance that we see around us? And the viewpoint I have is something that comes from loop quantum gravity, if you want, or from canonical quantum gravity, or it could be more general than that. I mean, it comes from general covariance, if you want. Anything that is observable in general relativity or in general covariant theory is relational in nature. So in the classic, so that's why I'm trying to represent this by this little picture that that reminds us that even in classical general relativity, when we make any physical statement, we are thinking about roads and clocks, or we are thinking about test observers probing the geometry or probing the system. So this discreteness then should be of a similar nature. We might not be able yet to write it explicitly, but it has to be relational in nature. And so what we think is that in order the probes that would be sensitive to this discreteness will have to be probes that are like clocks that come with their own clock and with their own ruler. And so they have to be scale-breaking degrees of freedom. So massive as opposed to massless degrees of freedom. Why? Because, I mean, photons or a massless scale-invariant degree of freedom would not... An excitation cannot select in a relational manner its rest frame with respect to which this discreteness would make sense. Only scale-breaking degrees of freedom could do that. And so this guides us to choosing the scalar curvature as a natural order parameter in the sense that the scalar curvature is linked via Einstein's equations to the trace of the energy momentum tensor. And so the notion of curvature that is relevant for us to parameterize the effect that we have in mind is the scalar curvature that will be zero, will be different from zero only if we have scale-breaking degrees of freedoms around. So with this remark, then I think I can introduce the model. So the model consists of giving a deviation, a geodesic, from geodesic motion for a test particle moving in space-time, a friction-like effect due to the presence of this underlying granularity. So for concreteness, think of cosmology. We want to apply this to cosmology. So in cosmology, we have the preferred frame of co-moving observers that defines a vector field that I will call psi here. And now we have our particle with four velocity u. So we want to write an expression for an acceleration of this particle. The acceleration has to be normal to the particle four velocity, and the only intrinsic direction associated to a particle would be given by its spin. So the particle has to be spinning. And if it has a non-trivial spin, then the force will have to be proportional to the spin. Then the rest is basically dimensional analysis. We put the scalar curvature here with the idea that scale invariant matter does not suffer nor sources this frictional force. Again, this is supposed to be a leading term. There could be higher curvature corrections that we are not interested in, that will be just sub-leading in the calculations that I will show you in a moment. There is the mass of the particles, so massless particles would not suffer this force. And this is the Planck mass square. And there is a coupling constant alpha, which is dimensionless. And if the model makes sense, we would like this alpha to be order one. And finally, there is this sine term. We're going to talk more about this. This is a term that we have to put here if we want this force to be non-conservative. And here it's hard to understand, but it's easier to see what I'm trying to say. So we want this to be a friction-like force, a non-conservative force. So, and this sign allow us to achieve this. And to see this, yes?
If you are not at the smooth scale, and so you are in
discrete. I am at the smooth, I am making an effective description. I am at the smooth scale in which I can, I mean, I want to use differential geometry and covariant derivatives to describe this effect at an effective level.
Okay, so the question was,
It's like when you write the Langevin equation,
yeah.
You don't use molecules, right?
Do you have an analog for friction, or can you describe it at a discreteness scale?
I am describing it at the effective level, and at the discrete scale is a more complicated question, and it would be interesting to investigate it. I don't have it, okay? Why is it that I need this sign? It's because if you look at now the way, I hope I won't break the. It's not a cathodic screen, right? So it's not dangerous.
Well, it's dangerous if you break it.
For me?
Yes.
Okay, so if you look at the way the energy of the particle, the mechanical energy of the particle changes along energy defined now with respect to these co-moving observers, along the particle's trajectory, then you find this equation using this one, in which you have the second term that you can identify. It would be zero if the a vector field psi would be a Keeling field, is non-zero in an expanding universe, and this has a very natural, we know what it is, it corresponds to redshift. The universe is expanding, the energy of the particle changes because of redshift. That's the second term. And the first term is a term that comes from our diffusion effect, and we see that it has a definite sign. It implies that the energy is lost, and the effect only stops. And this is thanks to this sign here, only stops when the inner product of the spin with the co-moving frame is zero. That means when the particle is at rest with respect to the co-moving field.
It's so non-analytic. Why do you want it to be so?
Well, we'll talk about it in a moment. I mean, that was a simple guess. You can make it smooth, and we're going to need to make it smooth for things that I want to mention later. But everything. So this is going to be replaced by something smooth, but the conclusions that come next will be the same, okay? Because basically the problem is at the point where this is zero, okay? And we're going to be away from that in the application of this equation, because we're going to apply this to the cosmology in a situation where particles have very high kinetic energy, and so we are always away from this inner product being zero. Yes?
Is it true that if you didn't have that sine term, you would break violet parity?
Yeah, that's true.
So that's another rationale for that?
Yes, yes.
Something like some odd term.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. Because I'm having trouble reading it. The C is just some fixed frame, fixed field that you.
It's the co-moving frames in cosmology. Why? Yeah, this. Yeah, I understand the question. So this field is supposed to be selected by the environmental matter that around. Okay,
it's. So some sort of non-locally defined.
Yes, exactly, exactly. Well, it is the matter that sources this scalar curvature that we think.
His only role is to distinguish the future light cone from the past light cone.
No, it has, yeah, but it selects a time-like direction, a very specific time-like, a specific frame, and it is breaking, in this sense, Lorentz invariance. Okay. In a mild way, only in this sign, but then.
Only in the sign?
Yeah, but then.
No, but the idea is also that. Lose energy and then align themselves to this flow because it's a friction term, no?
The equation would do that, yes.
The equation would do that.
Okay. But it's because psi is in this equation. Yeah.
It's not just selecting the future versus gas life from because it depends on this inner product.
Yeah. It's selecting a frame and a preferred notion of energy. So only massive and spinning particles feel this force. And here's a cartoon that makes a lot of sense to me. I don't know if if you will find it. I find this very intriguing and nice. So remember, we are thinking of these particles as probes of space-time geometry. And so it's true that so only massive and spinning excitations are the ones that we are selecting via the structure of this equation. The other ones wouldn't have a spin to define an intrinsic direction that is normal to the four velocity. But also, think of them as probes. Then you see that a scalar excitation, massive or massless, is just a one-dimensional probe because there is only, if I think of it as point particles, it's only direction. The only thing that it has. Intrinsic property is the four momentum, and so it moves along a one-dimensional wall line. So I can think of it as a one-dimensional probe of space-time. Massless spinning excitations, like a photon or a massless fermion, is a 3D probe because there is the four momentum and then the transverse directions where the polarizations live or where the spin live. Only massive and spinning particles are genuine four-dimensional probes of space-time because I have the four momentum and the three-dimensional orthogonal space where the spin can move around. So it's suggestive or interesting to me to make this statement because it suggests perhaps that the granular structure that is compatible with this equation that we are writing should be thought as four-dimensional concerning, and this goes to the question you raised before. So, and that there is something about four-dimensional grains in this selecting these particles as special. So to say, if space-time is discrete, made of four-dimensional grains, and then something that is a lower-dimensional probe might sneak through without feeling any effect, while a four-dimensional probe would just get a Brownian type of diffusion against these grains. And the structure of this equation is essentially unique. Once you assume that the right curvature that goes there is a scalar curvature, and so we can discuss about why this is basically unique. So there are not much other things that you can write, but I would like to move on because I have many things to tell you. We can come back later if you want. So first, this equation looks familiar, should look familiar. It looks like the Papapetrou-Dixon equation for the description of the motion of extended bodies in general relativity that have spin in curved spacetimes. And it also looks like the equation for trajectories in the WKB approximation of the Dirac equation in curved spacetimes. It looks also like the Langevin equation in the sense that it leads to this non-conservative effect. Energy is lost, and there is this friction aspect of it.
But you don't have a random part, right?
No. So, no.
Is there an action?
An action?
Whose equations of motion are these? Like the Birdman action?
No, I don't know. But it's hard to write an action, right? There has to be some time dependence in the action or some environment that will lead to this. Okay. So, which is something I might comment on later. I mean, all this. So one thing we're thinking about is how to generalize this to field theory. And so then it has to, you might think of a way of doing that, but then you would need to describe some interaction with an environment that would lead to this non-conservative aspect. And so it's complicated, but it's working. I mean, we are working on it. Okay, so we come back to the plan. So we have now, in principle, we have a model now. Because if you have a non-conservative effect on a single particle, then from there you can compute what happens to an ensemble of particles and compute the divergence of T mu nu, which is that you can do what you can do. So from this particle equation, you can define an ensemble and do a relativistic kinetic theory and calculate the T mu nu associated to this ensemble of particles and calculate its divergence. And what you find is what you see here. The details are not important, but the effect, so J would be proportional to the scalar curvature, the temperature of the fluid. Again, we're assuming this ensemble is in thermal equilibrium. We're going to apply this to cosmology, where we assume that matter will be in thermal equilibrium. Times, so the scalar curvature, the temperature, times a sum over the different species of your matter model, say the standard model, of the traces of the energy momentum tensor of each one of the species weighted with the spin, the magnitude of the spin of the particles. And the whole thing times this particular time-like vector field. So the current, because of homogeneity and isotropy, cannot be anything else but proportional to the co-moving time flow.
I'm still confused by that as that psi term. So psi is a time-like vector. So if you go to the rest frame, it's just 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. So what is S dot psi? I mean, what would be the...
S dot psi would be something like the velocity with respect to this frame times some cosine of some angle.
Okay.
Okay?
I see.
So as the velocity goes to zero, this goes to zero.
Okay, I see.
Okay?
One more question. Do you consider that the theory then, because it's time dependent, that it, does it break time symmetry? If the Lagrangian would be time-dependent?
Yeah, there would be some irreversible, there is an irreversible aspect of this, but at the effective level. So if we, it's only at this level that we would see this. So the idea is that behind that, there should be a fundamental description where, as usual, things are time-reversible.
And can you give a hint on how do you get this effective irreversibility from a pure time symmetric discreteness?
No. So all your questions point at having some understanding of how to get to something like that from a fundamental quantum gravity theory. And for the moment, I don't have much to say about that.
Okay.
It would be very nice, but it's not.
That would be very nice.
Okay. So, so now let me. Well, one more thing I should have mentioned here. This is the, because the trace of the energy momentum tensor of a species goes like the mass square of the particle, then the term that dominates the most in the standard model will be the top quark term. And so you can forget about the others if you want to get a quick order of magnitude estimate. You don't need to. And if you do that, then the current simplifies and to something like that. And this is only important for understanding this quick order of magnitude estimate that I will show you now. So the thing is that if you apply this to the universe, there is no diffusion before the electroweak transition, if you believe in the standard model, because before the electroweak transition, all massive particles are spinless. So spinning massive particles appear at the electroweak transition first. So J starts being not non-zero at the electroweak transition, and so you can compute the contribution from this model to the cosmological constant or to dark energy. And the assumption we introduce also is that the cosmological constant was initially zero before, okay? So if you assume that, then you compute lambda using just the standard model of cosmology, the standard dynamics of the background. You will see later that this energy momentum violation does not affect the dynamics of the background in any important way. And so you find the result that goes like the mass of the top quark in this top quark approximation. You don't need to do it, but if you did that, it goes like top quark mass to the power of fourth times the electroweak transition temperature to the third divided by the Planck mass to the seventh times the Planck mass squared. And this, because the top quark mass is of the order of the electroweak transition temperature, this goes like the electroweak transition temperature of the Planck mass to the power of 7, which happens to be 10 to the minus 120. And so from this, you get...
I got totally lost. How did you jump from J to lambda?
Ah, you are right late, I think.
Oh, okay.
No, but let me tell you, it's here. We use unimodular gravity, and in unimodular gravity, the cosmological constant comes as an integration constant when you conserve energy. If you don't conserve energy, then the violation, J is divergence of T mu nu. Just look at the trace-free Einstein's equations, use Bianchi identities, and assuming that J is integrable, that dj is equal to zero, you get an effective Einstein's equations where J feeds a dark energy component. Okay? Yeah.
But you assume whatever is lost in the dissipation is funneled into lambda.
Exactly. Yes?
Not only a massive spin particle will feel this effect, also like Higgs mechanism, like for example, the web might be deformed by it. So is there a comparison of for above 100 GeV, like whether massive spin particle field is stronger or the deformation of?
So before the electroweak transition, we are assuming there are no massive spinning particles, okay? Mm-hmm. So the thing, I don't know if this is what you're, so we don't know exactly what the electroweak transition temperature is. Is that the question you're asking?
The question would be the deformation on any Lorentz symmetry will change the Higgs mechanism.
Ah, okay. Yes.
So that will be an effect.
Yeah, I don't know much to say about it, except for something that comes in a moment, that the... there might be something, but let me go on and you will see. There might be something I can say, I mean.
Maybe it's a little bit tangential, but what about
okay, good. That's a good question. So maybe I am answering now this question. The point is that this is how, because the effect goes like the density square. So at the hadronization time, the density is way too much smaller than at the electroweak transition. So there will be a contribution there, but it would be totally subleading to this cosmological constant with respect to the effect that you get at the electroweak transition. Okay? Because the argument, so J goes like R, scalar curvature square.
Are you assuming that the neutrinos are massless
Yes, I am assuming that. So I am assuming that if they get mass, it has to be linked to the electroweak transition too, I suppose. Or at least I have to assume, I mean, if they were not massless, there would be some contribution from before. And I mean, if they have been around for way too long, this can change completely the result. Okay, so it depends. If they were not massless before, one has to look at it.
Is this lambda also time dependent?
Yes. So this lambda is time dependent, and this is the time. This is the time dependence of it. So at the electroweak transition, this is a picture. You have one over z here. So at the electroweak transition, It grows very quickly, but as the universe dilutes and R goes to zero, it essentially settles to virtually to a constant. Okay, even though it's growing in a negligible way. Okay, and here you see a picture in which we plot the value of alpha, the dimensionless parameter that you would need to explain the observations, as a function of the temperature of the electroweak transition, and you see that for a wide range of transition temperature, alpha is always order one. So if you buy this, then this would resolve the fine-tuning problem. There is no fine-tuning in this model. Okay, so this is the first part of the talk. Very quickly, these effects are extremely small on the background. If you look at how much energy you lose at the moment where the energy lost is maximal, so at the electroweak transition, in a Hubble time divided by the density at that time, you get 10 to the minus 51. So this is completely negligible in the dynamics of the background. So you create a cosmological constant there, and the only reason this is important is because the universe dilutes, and eventually it dilutes sufficiently so that this cosmological constant ends up dominating today. You can also compute. Yes, but the parameter alpha is the parameter alpha, as I said here, is order one. Okay, so if you tell me what is the electroweak transition, which is around 100 GeV, then I give you the parameter alpha that would correspond to what we observe. And if we change this by something, alpha doesn't change very much. Okay. Mm-hmm. But the nice thing about it is that alpha is not 10 to the minus 20 something or 10 to the 20 something, is order one. Okay, and now to your point. So if now radiative corrections should generate things in the effective Lagrangian, but they should be suppressed by the scalar curvature, because the scalar curvature is what mediates this effect. And so there are not many things that you can write. So you cannot write anything, you can write basically these two operators that are dimension lower than four. It depends how you count dimensions. These are not lower than four. This would be dimension five, I suppose, these are the things you can write, the leading terms that you can write that are Lorentz violating. So you can write something like that for the inflaton, but you cannot write anything for the Higgs, because the Higgs is not a singlet. And so there is no way to write at such a low dimensional operator for the Higgs. So there would be higher curvature terms, higher order terms, I suppose. And these are the things that I think you're evoking that could deform the Higgs mechanism. So, and then people have studied the Lorentz violating terms in an extension of the standard model. And so you might want to see whether these things are constrained by observations or by experiments. And so you find that in order to actually constrain this, you would need to go to densities that are comparable or correspond to temperatures, if you translate densities into temperatures, to 10 to the minus 8, the Planck temperature. So this is way far away from any possibility of local tests. So the Lorentz violating terms that this will generate are completely small and irrelevant for the test that we know. You can try to estimate the effect of this frictional force on, say, a neutron star made of many fermions. And you find, I don't know if you see this, but you find very small numbers. This force is extremely small. If you compare it with the gravitational binding force in the galaxy, so you make a dimensionless quantity, our force divided by the gravitational force binding the neutron star to the galaxy, you find something that goes like alpha times 10 to the minus 32. So this is an extremely small effect. You wouldn't see anything. So this is kind of depressing also, because a model that predicts only one thing that is observable is a depressing model. So this is how we come to the second part, and where we are going to make like a wild jump, which I still I mean, this is the first time I talk about this, so I'm not used to, but I think it's interesting. So the question is, so this is depressing in the sense that all effects seem extremely tiny as matter densities go down when the universe grows. Nothing remarkable or interesting seemed to happen after the electroweak era. And we would like to have something to say, especially because observations strongly seem to strongly suggest that something anomalous and strange happens in the dark energy sector. I am talking about the so-called H0 tension. So the question is, could we say something about that? Can we stretch this to be able to say something? In the way it is presented things so far, we cannot say anything. Nothing happens in later times. In order to explain this tension, this H0 tension, it would seem that you would need dark energy to grow in more recent history of the universe, after the CMB, the CMB was formed. And so the idea is that what is it that happened after the CMB? So densities went down and down, if I consider cosmology. But then after the CMB, structure starts forming. And so we have a new situation in which high densities appear, and this new situation leads in particular to the formation of black holes. And so this is where the question is, are black holes something that in some regard can be sensitive to this granular structure that we are talking about? Can we make sense of the equations we wrote for particles now for black holes? Okay, so here are the equations that we postulated for these fundamental particles. There are two, there are two things. I didn't mention the second one, but we had this equation for the acceleration of the test particle. But together with that, you need an equation that tells you how the spin processes in order to keep the orthogonality between the spin and the four velocity. So the simplest equation you can write is written down here. The details, the spin precession is proportional to u, so that the scalar product between s and u would be maintained in time. So this is a complete set of equations for the fundamental particles. So now we want to generalize this to black holes with the idea that black holes are extremely simple systems with the same quantum numbers, in quotation marks, mass, spin, and if they're charged, the same geomagnetic numbers as point particles, and I'm thinking about stationary black holes and the Noether theorem here. So we want to explore the possibility that these black holes, which connect the matter that has formed them with the singularity at the Planck scale, could have, due to some effect that is not clearly understood, of course, but we have to have to do with quantum mechanics and its non-locality and the granularity of quantum gravity, could produce a diffusion effect as well. So we write this equation for the black hole, which looks the same as the one for the particle. We have a translational part, and we have an equation that gives us a precession term for the spin of the black hole. But now, because the black hole is not a fundamental particle, because the black hole is a macroscopic object, then the spin can change also due to a friction-like effect. And this seems completely natural to us. The reason behind it, and especially I like to use the spin as the example. So in the case of the fundamental particle, we cannot add a term that will lower the spin because the particle has already h bar over 2, its lowest values of spin, so spin cannot change. But for a black hole, there could be a diffusion term that slows the spin down. And the rationale behind could be the following. So if reality is discrete at the fundamental level, then there is no exact notion of axis symmetry or spherical symmetry. And so the rationale for us for conservation of energy, the rationale for conservation of spin is lost. So there could be an effect, and this probably is an effect. The question is how big that is. Okay? So that could be extremely small, completely suppressed, and so we wouldn't see any deviation from general relativity. But the exploration here is will lead to something that is not small, given some assumptions. So, yeah.
For macroscopic black holes?
Yeah, for macroscopic black holes.
Would there be not also other effects
which slow down the black holes?
Yeah, there are both things here.
No, I mean there's also other effects like super radiance, which reduce the spin.
Yeah, I think these effects will be subleading. These are bigger. This will be bigger if you put the couplings the way I will show you. So it depends on how big these couplings are.
Super radiance would only be an effect if you have.
There is Hawking radiation also.
Exotic particles or like axions.
And there is also Hawking radiation. That is a diffusion effect. So the black hole evaporates. So, but these are extremely subleading respect to the thing I will write next. So,
you said that the conservation of energy is also lost in quantum gravity along with conservation of spin because of.
In this effective description, if there is granularity, then the axis symmetry that prevents Kerr black holes to lose spin, stationary black holes to lose spin, I mean if you don't send anything, like super radiance, you need to send something that breaks, obviously. Then an isolated black hole would just be slowed down by the fact that there is an environment that cannot sustain spherical symmetry. It would be lost in the grains of space-time. So, okay, so.
Why should you assume there's any conservation of energy? If you have a discrete structure and you lose time translation invariance, what is the deep basis foundation of energy conservation?
I think I am agreeing with that. That's
even at the microscopic level.
At the microscopic level, I don't know. I think there could be. I mean, there is. We don't know what energy would mean at that level, but. That's what you're. Yeah, I agree. But there is something in the canonical formulation of quantum gravity. There is something that looks like conservation of energy, which would be satisfying the quantum constraints. It's a residue of it, or if you want, it's just the general covariance, the fact that there are no backgrounds. That's what I. No, I don't want to break that. I'm saying that. In this effective description, but I'm saying in the fundamental theory, perhaps, the fundamental theory will not break general covariance in the appropriate sense. And that is what I mean by conservation of energy, if you want. Okay, another thing that is relevant for this is something that Eugenio has emphasized also. Black holes that are spinless have at fixed mass, they have higher entropy than Bekenstein entropy than spinning black holes. So, and that's a fact, but in general relativity, there is nothing that allows for realized thermalizing, so to say, to this non-spinning black holes. So here, adding a term like this allows opens a channel for thermalization, opens a channel that can slow down the spin. And so let's look at the potential phenomenological implications of this. This is very recent, and we have not explored everything. It's complicated, but there are some things that one can say quickly. So if you look, you can look at the ratio of this force that we are postulating to the gravitational force in when two black holes are very close, that you can just estimate Newtonianly. And this is just a very order of magnitude estimate. And so you find that the force, if alpha, the coupling now in this translational part of the equations, would be order one, like for fundamental particles, then you get something completely crazy. You will get that the ratio is 10 to the 32 times the mass of the black hole divided by the mass, the solar mass, to the power of 4. So it's a huge effect. However, these are not fundamental particles. This is a macroscopic object. And so you could think that if you would understand the fundamental theory, there could be a suppression of this due to factors of the form 1 over square root of n, where n is the number of some quanta involved in the construction of a microscopic object. And so we can write two simple models. If we think of area quanta, then the suppression will go like M Planck over the mass. And so alpha will be something times M Planck over the mass. And now this estimate that was totally crazy becomes something much more reasonable. So you will have an effect, a force which be of the order of 10 to the minus 6. I think there is a problem with the powers here. One of the two is wrong. And I am unable to say now which one is the wrong one. But anyhow, I should look at the paper. There should be the same power here and here.
No, but the n is different.
No, you're right. No. Yeah, everything is fine. The power changes because there is a new suppression. Yeah, of course. Okay, and you get a 10 to the minus 6 here. If instead you think of mass quanta, now then the suppression would go like mass Planck over the mass of the black hole square root, and then you get bigger effects. You get a 10 to the 13 times mass over solar mass times 7 halves. But now again, this is a bound, it's a higher bound of the force. It assumes that the spin of the black hole is maximal, that these black holes are extremal. And not only that, it is assuming something about this sign. And now I go to the point that you raised at the beginning. So this thing cannot make sense for a black hole that is non-relativistic, because now this object, we're going to be very close to the zero of this sign. And this is what appears when I estimate the they are eventually relativistic because these are two merging black holes. But when I estimate the ratio of our force to the force that binds a black hole in our galaxy, now they are non-relativistic. They move at 10 to the minus 3, the speed of light, more or less. And so we need to regularize. We need to say something. We need to face the fact that this is not regular at the origin.
I got confused now. So the black hole itself, what do I need to care about the galaxy and how it's bound to the galaxy, the binding?
No, I'm just computing a dimensionless quantity, which is the force we postulate divided by the gravitational force in the galaxy. That gives me a dimensionless number. And I want this number. If this number is big, it would mean that the black hole will not follow a Newtonian trajectory in the galaxy. It will just do something else.
Why is it not the most relevant quantity is to consider the binding energy of the black hole itself? It's the only thing that matters in that whether it's bound to the galaxy or not. What does it matter?
No, it matters phenomenologically. If that would be a big number, then if I see a black hole, I would see it moving in an anomalous way, and that would be.
We have black holes that could have been kicked out of the galaxy, so you have black holes everywhere. So I don't understand why.
It's just a number to give you an idea of how big this force would be. But I think it is relevant if we could see black holes in our galaxy. But we do see. They wouldn't follow the trajectory we expect if this ratio would be big. And so there is, unfortunately, I don't think you see any of these equations from the distance. No? You don't see anything? Okay. So one thing I want to mention is that these type of corrections are things that we find, the square root of n corrections we find in some context in loop quantum gravity when we compute corrections to the entropy, the Bekenstein entropy. So that's one thing I should have mentioned. And the second thing is that instead of the sign, one should replace it by something regular. And something that seems like the natural thing to do is to use some power. It has to be an odd power of this ratio. Psi dot s divided by psi dot u, this behaves like a sign. In the high relativistic regime, it is the same as a sign, and it wouldn't change anything of what I said before for the cosmological constant. But in the non-relativistic regime, there is this ambiguity, this n, that can make this effect very, very small. So essentially, the effect will go like the velocity, the speed of the black hole, to some power of 2n plus 1. And if v is much less than 1, then you will get a suppression, which is what you see here. So I like to convince you, even though you don't see the equations, that the effects we get are not so big, but they are just right as big that could lead to some observable effect. And so let me also go to the spin friction term. So if you look, look at how the spin changes by doing the inner product of the equation for the precession of spin with the spin itself, then you get a very simple equation for the spin that tells you that the spin will go down exponentially with the time scale that you can compute. And so if you assume that the suppression goes like the square root of the mass of the of mass Planck over mass, then you get something quite interesting. You get a time for the slowing down to the black hole to a Schwarzschild black hole that goes like the square root of the mass of the black hole over the solar masses time 1 billion year divided by 158, which means that for a solar mass black hole, it would just stop. If it's extremal, it will stop in 6 million years. And for a standard mass black hole, it will stop in 60 million years. So which are long times for local observations, but extremely short times for cosmology. If instead you suppose that you have a suppression that goes like m Planck over mass, then you get that this never stops. It will stop in 10 to the many powers edges of the universe. Now, for supermassive black holes like those in the center of the galaxy, again, you get that the spin will last for many ages of the universe. Okay? So this will make intermediate mass black holes slow down, which seems to be compatible with some observations.
The measurements of the spin of black are still of black holes. So would this be then in conflict with those are spinning?
But these are surrounded by accretion disk, I imagine.
Yeah,
so this would be true only if you let the black hole alone for.
The time scale for a spin up by accretion disk is around 10 to the 8 years, I think. 10 to 8. So if this is shorter than that, or actually very close to it, I guess. and it's actually shorter than that, then the problem is that you can never spin up, right? So the accretion disk can never they have a maximum mass, right? And.
So what are the mass of these black holes for which we measure the spin?
There are 10 solar masses, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, it would be around the same scale.
Could be wrong. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Everything could be wrong. So.
Okay. There is a caveat in this solution. I mean, here, when I solve this and I get this simple exponential, I am assuming that the mass of the black hole is constant. But if the black hole is slowing down, then the mass would be changing. So in order to solve this, and what we would need to assume is something about, because there is another variable, and for concreteness, it seems like a natural assumption would be adiabaticity, namely that the area of the black hole is constant in the process, and then you would be able to actually solve this equation, and the solution would be different, but it wouldn't change the order of magnitude.
The area of the black hole would grow by a factor 2 or more. The mass of the black hole, the Perkin mass of the black hole.
No, so it doesn't change a lot. Yeah, that's right. So how much energy is available in this? So in the translational motion, nothing, because the black holes bound in galaxies move at non-relativistic speeds. So it's 10 to the minus 6. The ratio between the energy you can get to the mass of the black holes is 10 to the minus 6, something like that. Nothing. But slowing down the black holes has a lot of energy. So you can get up to 30% of their mass if they were initially extremal. So there is a lot of energy in this, and that could, if we put this in our scheme of unimolar gravity, and so as far as the description of the universe at large scale is concerned, we could do that. This could be an important source for growth of the dark energy at late times. So there seemed to be this discrepancy between what we measure for H0 from what we infer from Planck and the CMB physics with what we measure when we look at the local universe and we look at supernovae. And this suggests that dark energy is growing, and so a simple or naive interpretation of that is that the dark energy has an equation of state, W less than minus 1, and that would be totally crazy from the point of view of the dominant energy condition. It violates the dominant energy condition, which would mean that this fluid propagates faster than, sends energy faster than light. And so that's why I think it's hard to come up with relativistic models that will lead to something like that. However, in our scheme, we can accommodate a growing cosmological constant while keeping all the time omega equal to minus one, as you saw. Okay? So, and so what I want to show you in this last part is this work in progress with Edward Wilson-Ewing and Daniel, in which we do a rough estimate of what type of models could actually resolve the H0 tension. So let me just remind you very quickly the way in which you would measure H0 from observations at the CMB. So there are two things. There is one angle that you measure. Of course, you measure much more things, and so this is a Pulsman determination of H0. So you actually use all the data that come from the CMB and the baryonic acoustic oscillations, and you put everything together in some program that analyzes the data and give you the result. Now, this is a very simplistic view. Where you just use one observable, the angle of the peak of the power spectrum in the CMB. This is what you measure. Then there is something called the sound horizon. This is something you know from local physics at the CMB. And then this theta angle is given by the particle horizon, the sound horizon divided by the radius of the last scattering surface at the CMB. And that is the thing that depends on your cosmological model. It depends on what happens from the CMB until today. So if you give me a model of cosmology from the CMB to today, namely H of Z from the CMB to today, these two equations allow you to measure or calculate H today, H0. And so in our paradigm, what we have is this continuity equation where how much lambda changes is tied to how much rho matter changes. So you can rewrite this continuity equation in terms of a redshift, and then the models I will show you correspond to the calculation of H0, where we change the logic just for simplicity. We give a lambda of z, and we integrate the continuity equation to get rho of z. And so we studied simple models to show that very simple models would actually resolve or alleviate the tension. So here, the first model is a sudden jump model of dark energy. So dark energy, so there is a cosmological constant, and at some z, here z equal 1, it jumps to a different value. And when the continuity equation tells you that if lambda jumps, then rho matter has to drop because there is a diffusion of energy from rho matter to lambda. So these are the equations. It doesn't matter. Just look at the picture. The picture contains the information. And also, what is important and unfortunate is my notation. This omega lambda, lowercase omega lambda, would sound like the equation of state for cosmologists. And so it's a bad notation, but I didn't have time to change it. Here, omega lambda is simply lambda over 3H0 squared. So it's basically the cosmological constant in units of H0 squared. And omega matter is the same thing. It's rho matter times A pi G divided by H0 squared. So we see that if you look at this simple chi-square definition in which we have two terms, one that tell us the sum of two terms squared. The first is the requirement that the H0 we get from our model matches the H0 of supernova calculations to a certain number of sigmas, plus the other condition that we impose is that the density of matter at the CMB in our model is not very different from the density of matter in lambda CDM, because we don't want...
You're running out of time.
Yes, of course. So very quickly, this is just a model. And the important thing about this model is that there is a very clear space parameter where you can have the cake and eat it too, okay? And and this is at the expense of not too much of omega matter, so which makes you think that if you have a reasonable proportion of black holes that slow down, then you could eliminate the tension. And this is another model in which lambda behaves like something that grows with the power of a scale factor from some initial value. And again, there is the shaded parameter space here that shows that in these regions, you would be able to alleviate the tension. So I am finishing. So violations, so just the last two slides of discussion. Violations of energy momentum conservation are natural in effective description in terms of smooth fields of this physics that we imagine being fundamentally discrete from quantum gravity. When they satisfy suitable integrability conditions, we can describe this in unimodal gravity, and they feed a dark energy component. In the absence of any fundamental theory, our approach is phenomenological. And the constraints from low energy Lorentz invariants lead to an essentially unique leading contribution to this noisy diffusion. As I show you, the effects are tiny in laboratory experiments, but they also are tiny when they are maximal in cosmology. The only reason they become important is because the universe dilutes until this cosmological constant that has been generated dominates. And now, in later stages of the universe, observations suggest that dark energy grows again. Can we say something about that? And so if we think about these effects associated to black holes, it seems that we can. Black holes, it's an important part of matter in galaxies. Black holes interact with the Planck scale in quotation, we expect them via the presence of this singularity and the non-locality of quantum mechanics. And they are simple. They are as simple as point particles in some respects. So applying these effective equations, that we use for particles, to the case of black holes, we get a wide range of phenomenological implication that opens up and we should investigate, we would like to investigate. But in particular, we get this energy loss that could feed the growth of the cosmological constant. So we have to look at this in more detail, but that's basically the kind of things that we are working on at the moment. So to finish, this is the I am not trying to be pretentious, but this is when you read the last paragraph of the press release of the Nobel Prize of 2011, they end with this funny sentence, because we have discovered the universe is expanding. At the end, there is this funny sentence that says, "Now and everything is possible again." So I think there are true problems out there with the universe. There are things that we don't understand. And so to solve them, I believe we need, two requirements are necessary. One is we have to be bold. And second, we have to be right. I hope I have convinced you that I am satisfying the first of the requirements.
I was confused when people introduce time-dependent cosmological constants. So maybe at the start you say it's an integration constant of unimodular gravity, so it should be a true constant, right? And then you say, oh, it's time-dependent, but this violates your initial assumption of it being a constant.
It's not a constant if divergence of T mu nu is not zero. That's the point. In unimodular gravity, it's only a constant of integration if you conserve, if you have local conservation of energy. Okay, it comes from, sorry, this is far away. Oh, I went too far. This comes from integrating this equation. Usually, usually you have zero on this side and then you have a constant. So unimodal gravity is the very natural setup where the cosmological constant can depend on time if you have this diffusion.
So from the fact that you have something like the Langevin equation, you'd expect that lambda is also stochastic, right? And there's some stochasticity that should come in, but you don't seem to have anything stochastic
in. I suppose in the details. Like when you look at the Langevin equation, you can forget about this, the Brownian noise in some descriptions, and describe the microscopic motion that slows down. I think this is at that level is where we are, But if you have a better understanding of the microscopic theory, perhaps there would be also, there would be fluctuations around this.
Any of these things are things that we've been discussing in our meeting just now, which is...
I know, yes.
There's many analogies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But there's some very fundamental differences as well. Mm-hmm. But just to ask one last question, could you also think of this thing coming from some other, not just from quantum gravity, but maybe some, you know, if you had another degree of freedom, which is like a fast degree of freedom, sort of a, as a Born-Oppenheimer kind of approximation, rather than something coming from fundamental discreteness, because that doesn't seem to be necessary for you.
What do you mean? Like,
it could come from some
other fluid, some.
Or even some more fundamental degrees of freedom, which are fast degrees of freedom.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I am not.
I don't see where quantum gravity necessarily comes into your model.
I mean, the rational is constructed with the idea of discreteness in quantum gravity, and the form of this equation, the motivation for the form of the equation also. But I suppose, yeah, there could be other contexts in which this makes sense. Bianca?
So part of your proposal is, if I understood correctly, that some percentage of the energy of rotating black holes, maximally 30%, account for the H0 tension.
Mm-hmm.
Is there enough known about the distribution of these rotating black holes to say whether the numbers match up, or was it?
I don't know the details, but I think it's not. We don't know a lot about the population of black holes and the way they form and they evolve. So all this will have to go in. So these models I show at the end are very simple models that have no physics in them, just to show that you can write some simple model in which something happens for reason Z and you resolve the H0 tension. What you need to know is how many black holes are formed during galaxy formations and what are the spins, and those are things we have not studied. But this model suggests that you would need very little of raw matter going into black holes, and I think the amount that you would need is not ruled out by what we think the number of black holes out there could be. You know, people thought that black holes could make up the whole of dark matter, and these things have been constrained. So now they cannot be not the whole dark matter fluid can be made of black holes. But I think, No, I'm saying that there could be an important portion of dark matter that corresponds to black holes, and that if they have been formed with high spin and they have slowed down, they would provide the energy for this. Okay, so for the moment, all these are speculations and speculative ideas, and we need to have more time to investigate whether this is reasonable or not.
Just one quick question. So in these examples, I have no idea. Unimolar gravity. So you have a source, as the previous question mentioned, where you're saying, well, if your energy is not conserved, then it's having an effect.
Mm-hmm.
And that effect is tied to the curvature of the object you're
studying. Mm-hmm.
So there's a non-trivial feedback mechanism.
Yes, that's right. But the effect...
So here you were using some concepts of black holes that you know from generativity. Do you know that the black holes of unimolar are A, the same, B, are stable?
Mm. You mean if this is what is it?
Do I have any right to call for the black holes of generativity to guide the calculations in a different theory? Where
I understand the question. I don't know. You're saying are they crab stars or kappa stars?
I'm not sure if this theory, with this particular phenomenology, has anyone studied where these black holes form and are stable?
I think these effects, if they make sense, they have to be small deviations from general relativity, and as I show you in some of these models, they are, and then I would expect that black holes form as in general relativity up to some deviations.
And the deviation will be tied to the curvature. So you're implicitly saying that there will be an extra hair in black holes that will depend on the mass of the black hole.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps, yeah, for small black holes, it would be maybe some anomalous effect. Yes?
Somewhat similar to Sumati's question. I'm confused about the relationship. On the one hand, you have an underlying discreteness that you postulate. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you have breaking of Lorentz invariance. And on the other hand, you have this friction effect. Now, if I think your point of view was that the discreteness will break Lorentz invariance.
It breaks it in a relational way. The presence of matter, which are the things that probe the space-time, will select by their, in some Machian way, the a preferred frame. So in the sense that this that you and I break Lorentz invariance here.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it the breaking of Lorentz.
Okay, then I don't break Lorentz invariance. Then I don't break Lorentz invariance.
That doesn't break Lorentz invariance.
Sorry?
Is your point of view that the discrete structure will not break Lorentz invariance?
Yeah, I think so. It would, I mean, that this discreteness would make sense in some relational way in terms of Dirac observables, right? And that is the kind of thing that you wouldn't call breaking of Lorentz invariance. You are there, and I see you, and so.
But, I mean, let me ask the question that leads to, I think maybe I see the answer now. If you say that the energy lost to this friction goes into the cosmological constant, it would seem that the rationale for that would require Lorentz invariance. Because otherwise there could be any kind of effective stress energy taking, you know, being fed by that friction. It seems to me it's only if you assume some sort of Lorentz invariance that the effective stress energy should look like a cosmological constant. Or do you have some other rationale?
I guess it's a unimodal gravity that produces this Lorentz, this cosmological constant that does not break.
No, but if you have other hidden degrees of freedom, then absorbing this energy.
But I don't think of these hidden degrees of. Okay, I am thinking of the discreteness. It's not sitting there. Discreteness is something that I will see, like the mass of a scalar field, for example. The mass of a scalar field is a scale, but that doesn't break scale invariance. That doesn't break Lorentz invariance, being an energy scale. We know it means the mass of the particle in its own rest frame. So we are thinking that discreteness is something like that. So the discreteness is something that realizes when you probe the space-time, when you look at some relationships between what would be a space-time geometry and the probing degrees of freedom. So that's why we select this scale-breaking degrees of freedom, particles that can select their own rest frame, and with respect to their own rest frame, they see these grains. So the rational is Lorentz invariant. But then when you have...
So in the end, you are relying on some sort of Lorentz
invariant. Yes. Yes. I think in the back of my mind, I have the idea of canonical quantum gravity, that anything that is observable is does not select any preferred frame. Is a relation between different degrees of freedom, and that goes into the cooking up this this equation. I mean, selecting this equation.
Okay, this time is
but
slowly. And there's still enough time to ask Alejandro because he will be here until at least until Friday.
Yes.
And so let's take him again.
Okay, thank you.